Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we'll learn about a new partnership in Fresno County that aims to take 24 nonprofit organizations and governmental institutions and get them all on board on one thing, the Cradle to Career Partnership. We'll also find out why a rather unusual species is drawing bird lovers from all over to Bakersfield. And we'll talk about the effort to save ancient Native American languages and a project going on right now at Fresno State. Before that, though, we turn our attention to public safety and a big word this time of year, voter-approved taxes. Throughout the Central Valley, communities are grappling with how to keep their towns safe with enough cops and firefighters on the beat. Many local governments say the traditional revenue sources simply aren't enough. But how these communities are choosing to fund these essential services is diverging down several different paths. Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess reports community reaction to tax increases plays a big role in how local political leaders decide to act.
As children, most of us went to sleep hearing the story of Goldilocks and the Three Bears. In it, Goldilocks tries three bowls of porridge, one too hot, one too cold, and...
"Ah, this porridge is just right," she said happily, and she ate it all up.
That story is similar to the choice local officials are faced with trying to determine what is just right when it comes to how to get new money to fund government services. This summer, Kern County, Madera County, and Visalia have all considered asking voters to pay more to improve public safety. In Madera, the concern is fire protection. In Kern County, low oil prices have caused massive budget cuts. And in Visalia, council members are trying to augment an existing safety sales tax. But all three are trying different bowls of porridge. In Madera, the County Board of Supervisors decided to place an initiative on the March ballot asking for a 1 cent sales tax, with about 80% going to fire protection. Because the funds are going to a dedicated source, 2/3 of the county's voters will have to support it. Bill Ritchie is on the committee tasked with selling the sales tax to the public and says there's a reason they opted for the harder goal.
To gain the public's trust and assure them that these funds would only be used for public safety, meaning law enforcement and fire protection, although it would be a higher threshold to achieve a victory in passage, the Board of Supervisors has opted for the special tax option as opposed to a general tax.
Ritchie says polling they have done shows about 72% of residents support the tax, and they felt safe that they could reach the 2/3 support necessary for passage. That is not the case in Visalia, where city officials say support for tax increases is a bit cooler. The Visalia City Council is asking for a tax increase that is smaller, a half a cent. But because the revenue is not dedicated to a specific goal, only a bare majority of voters would need to endorse it. That has strong pull in the valley, where other tax increases over the past year have gone down to defeat. Visalia Police Chief Jason Salazar acknowledges the council is taking this approach because polling indicated it's all the support they could achieve, despite the public not having assurances that the council will actually spend the money on public safety.
And basically the returns on those indicated that the 50% vote is something that had they got positive returns from. Anything higher was less likely to be something that would be passed.
But the flexibility has perks too, Salazar says, including being able to use the money on streets or parks. And if voters are unhappy, they can replace council members. That vote is in November. But resistance to taxes in the south part of the valley may be so hot that some voters won't even get a chance to have a say. The Kern County Sheriff lobbied vigorously to have a public safety tax added to the ballot, in this case the 2/3 type, but was unable to persuade the Board of Supervisors to take the issue to voters. Supervisor Leticia Perez, who was the only supervisor to support a vote on the tax, says trying to get the lower threshold tax was not even considered.
Maybe this is a time under the current crisis to reconsider or business as usual and think about how we can bring revenue in, desperately needed revenue, and restore some of these incredible cuts to public safety and, of course, other departments.
Sheriff Donnie Youngblood says that not even considering the tax will mean layoffs and decreased coverage in parts of the sprawling county.
In my opinion, to do nothing was not the answer. I don't do well doing nothing when we have a problem. I felt like we should at least give the public the opportunity. It's not saying that they should support the vote of the public, but I think that we should have put it on the ballot.
Tellingly, a campaign to apply a sales tax for the public library system barely managed to cross the 50% measure in a June vote. That's not a flawless predictor of what would happen to a public safety tax, but it does illustrate the deep-seated reluctance to support additional taxes. Supervisors did say they would be open to a community-driven effort to place a tax on the ballot. So it breaks down to a higher threshold with guarantees for voters, a lower number that's easier to pass but not guaranteed, or no vote at all because taxes are just too hot. The Goldilocks voters will have to decide what's just right. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Jeffrey Hess.
This is Valley Edition. Right now in California's Sierra Nevada, an estimated 66 million trees have died due to a deadly combination of drought and bark beetles, which take advantage of dry, thirsty trees. But could we prevent beetles from ever attacking trees in the first place? FM89's Carrie Klein introduces us to a new tool that fends off bark beetles using the very thing that makes them so deadly.
Take a look at a mountain pine beetle, and you probably won't see much. A tiny black and brown pellet around the size of a mouse dropping. It looks simple, kind of dumb, really. And yet, as forester Brian Block with Sequoia National Forest explains, these seemingly unassuming insects are taking out millions of towering, stately trees. He and I are looking at a tall, brown sugar pine near Lake Isabella.
How does something so small kill something so big?
Sheer numbers. Thousands and thousands of little pinpricks.
One beetle on its own, the tree can probably defend itself. But these beetles don't travel alone. They ambush. And together, that army burrows under a tree's bark and cuts off the nutrient highway that runs from roots to canopy and back. So how do they do it? Well, they're not super strong. They're not super smart. They certainly can't talk or text each other. But what they do have is a great sense of smell.
When the beetles come in and they start successfully hitting this tree, they emit pheromones that say, come get this tree. And so thousands of beetles will come and attack this tree. And that's usually how the trees end up losing.
That's right. Mountain pine beetles navigate the world using pheromones. A bunch of beetle species do. Researchers at the Forest Service saw their carnage and asked, if pheromones can be used to help beetles, why can't they be used against them? And that's the principle behind a promising new tool called SplatVerb.
SplatVerb is a relatively new product that's been designed for use for protecting trees from bark beetle attacks using their own pheromone.
That's Chris Fettig, a research entomologist with the U.S. Forest Service and one of SplatVerb's developers. He describes it as a thick, gooey substance that squeezes out of a caulking tube.
It's kind of a brownish-grayish color. In terms of the consistency, it's a bit more viscous than perhaps toothpaste.
The pheromone we talked about earlier is called an aggregation pheromone. It's like an open for business sign for beetles around a tree. But beetles produce another important pheromone too, one that says, back off, buddy, this tree has already been eaten.
Once that tree begins to fill up, the beetles switch to production of an anti-aggregation pheromone, which essentially focuses as a no-vacancy sign. This tree's full, please disperse and attack the next adjacent tree.
That anti-aggregation pheromone is called verbenone, and it's the verb in SplatVerb. Splat is an acronym for the gooey substance that surrounds the verbenone and releases it slowly over time. It stands for Specialized Pheromone and Lure Application Technology. It's actually been used to deploy many different pheromone-based chemicals. This isn't the first time verbenone has been used either. The pheromone was first discovered in the 1960s, and research since then has explored which beetles are susceptible to it and how best to apply it. In the late 90s, researchers developed slow-release verbenone pouches. Then came a solid described to me as a verbenone sandwich. SplatVerb, the latest iteration, has been commercially available since 2014. You can find it online or in a handful of specialized ag supply stores throughout the state. Studies show it to be more effective than its predecessors, at least in some circumstances.
At the individual tree level, based on the results published by these researchers, I will say it seems promising.
That's Nader Erbilgin, a forest entomologist at the University of Alberta in Canada. He wasn't involved in creating Splatfur, but he did develop earlier verbenone treatments. He talks about the individual tree level because that's where the data shows Splatverb is most powerful. Developers found the substance was highly effective when applied to individual trees. But when they spaced it out in a grid pattern within a larger stand of trees, it didn't work as well. Erbilgin says, yeah, Splatverb won't save our forests, and it wouldn't have even if we'd used it before the latest outbreak. But he says we shouldn't expect such power from a tool like this.
Oh, tree mortalities cannot be solved by entomologists or by this kind of management. You know, I work in this subject too. I'm not being critical of my colleagues, but this kind of activities might provide short-term solutions to deal with when the problem occurs, but we really need a long-term solutions to improving forest health.
Like forest thinning and maintaining species diversity.
Forest health is really complex. It's not just the insects, not just the pathogens, not the diseases. It's a lot of things happening below ground that we're really scratching the surface right now.
In other words, for a handful to a few acres of trees, Splatverb could probably help protect them, but leave the forests to the foresters. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
This is Valley Edition. There's a new effort in Fresno County to gather resources and attention to focus on many critical issues when it comes to solving social ills, dealing with our children. The group is called the Cradle to Career Partnership, and it's a project of 24 nonprofit organizations, governments, and more. Joining us now, we have two guests, the superintendent of the Fowler Unified School District, Eric Cedarquist, and also Linda Gleason, who is the director of Cradle to Career. Linda, I want to start with you. If you had to, if you were stuck in an elevator with somebody and had to explain what exactly your group is doing, how would you explain that?
Well, we're bringing together all the different sectors that are connected to doing work for children in Fresno County, and we're committed to a set of goals. Three priority areas: kindergarten readiness, making sure our kids are ready for kindergarten; third grade reading, making sure they're reading proficiently by third grade, and that they're graduating from high school. And what's different this time is we're committed to using data to determine what we're doing and how those improvements are actually working. And we're actually reporting out how we're doing and committed to improving at certain percentages each year.
Now, you have school districts, you have nonprofits, you have local governments, and I should say the James Irvine Foundation is backing this. They also are a supporter of this station, as most public radio stations in California. Eric, I want to turn to you. As a member of one of these organizations, what was it like getting on board with this? Was there consensus on these are the issues we want to tackle, and we all commit to do this? Was it an easy yes, or was there some deliberation there?
It's a little bit different initiative in terms of what schools are used to. We're used to dealing with children from ages five on, and so it's a different mindset, especially from the womb to age five. But when the three markers that Linda talked about, all school districts can rally around those, because we realize in Fresno County, those are some areas where we have some need for tremendous improvement.
So what does it mean in real terms for your district being involved in something like this, especially in that that period before kids are actually in your schools in Fowler? What are you doing to be a part of this group?
It has transformed our district in terms of what we do. We now look at children and we look at parents much differently. We look at parents from pregnancy, in terms of engaging them in parent education, engaging children in services that can be provided to children from ages 0 to 4 before they enter our school system. So, and in addition to that, the resources that are now available to us from other agencies, specifically in the areas of health, dental, vision, that can be provided to families who have tremendous needs, especially in areas of poverty, of which there are many, in Fresno County.
So when it comes to cradle to career, are you the first point of contact with these families, or are you an organization that's working with all these different partners, and one of them might be the first contact or a different avenue depending on the particular issue that a family is facing?
The Cradle to Career Partnership is really about shepherding these resources. So we're connecting, making sure that these different sectors are connected, that the DA is connected to the school districts, to the juvenile justice campus, to the public health department, to Valley Children's Community Medical Center. And we're really about making sure that those connections are happening and that they are connected to the narrative, to the issues, and what we believe need to happen with regard to those in order to improve the outcomes for our kids.
Eric, we're talking about this, obviously begging the question that, that there is a big problem out there, a disconnect, and that we have all of these indicators that for so long in the Valley have been pointing in the wrong direction. Maybe they've been trending up, or they're still down, much lower than the rest of the state in many ways, from employment to incarceration and those sorts of things. From a real-world level, what makes you encouraged about this project and the challenges, given the challenges that you're already facing in with your schools?
I'd say it's a collective impact. It's the realization that we're all in this together and that there's no one sector, whether it's health, whether it's education, as an example, that is operates in isolation. We're now all in this together, and everybody has seen the relationships and the connectivity and the emphasis on this partnership has probably never been greater in Fresno County. And so this Cradle to Career is an initiative that can transform the Valley, transform this region over a period of time.
Now, Linda, this is not the first time local nonprofits, local governments have gotten together and said, you know, we don't want to duplicate resources. We want to align along major goals. For the better part of 15 years, we've seen efforts like this from the Collaborative Regional Initiative, the Regional Jobs Initiative, the Human Investment Initiative, Fresno Compact. How is this different? You mentioned data. Mm-hmm. What do you do with that data, mm-hmm. and why is that important in what you're doing?
Mm-hmm. Well, it is incredibly important and the key point of difference. I think this has really been a big piece of this is about freeing the data. What we're focusing in on is making sure that we're working with actionable data. So often you'll hear in Fresno County what we call summary level data. 1 in 3 children living in poverty. 98% of the children in Fresno Unified on free and reduced lunch. I think what we're really about is breaking that down into what do we know about this group of kids that are getting these kinds of interventions, and how are those interventions actually impacting a benchmark down the road? So if we know a kid isn't ready for kindergarten, what do we need to be doing better to make sure they are ready, which then will impact their ability to be reading at grade level by third grade?
So you're looking at this at a micro level or a macro level? You're looking at an individual student's performance, or you're tracking overall broad trends and then saying, you know what, we're seeing that reading at the third grade level is really not progressing as fast as we had thought. We need to reallocate resources there, or is it Johnny is not doing well in school? We need to make sure that Fowler Unified knows, and that the other resources that are out there, maybe there's something that the family, other resources the family could assist with. Is it micro or is it macro?
It's micro. And it won't be necessarily Johnny isn't doing well, but Johnny's. Okay. So there are privacy issues related to data that we have to be careful about, but we're getting as granular, as micro as we possibly can with regard to what do we know about these children and what services they're being provided? What are the real issues that are happening inside their homes and in their neighborhoods? And as a result, what are we designing in order to properly impact that child or that family? So we're really working on improving the way we're being informed, not only by the data, but also by the amount of information that we're gathering from the people that are closest to these children, their parents, and the neighborhoods around them.
We're talking about the Cradle to Career Partnership today on Valley Public Radio. It's a new effort in Fresno County to bring together local government, nonprofits, education institutions, all around a set of goals and measuring data and performance in these various areas to get kids on a good track to getting a job and getting an education. Eric, we have listeners from the top of the grapevine all the way to the edge of the Delta. For people who aren't familiar with Fowler in your community, tell us about, you know, the assets and also the challenges that you face in your district.
Fowler Unified School District is a district with 78% of our students qualify for free and reduced lunch. We take in the areas, in unincorporated areas of Malaga, which is one of the most challenged areas in terms of poverty, but is a very high achieving, one of our highest achieving schools in our district. And so Fowler is kind of a microcosm of Fresno County in that has tremendous needs, and this initiative provides the services that isolated areas may not be able to access in terms of areas Huron, Riverdale, Carruthers, areas on the west side of Mendota, San Joaquin, Fireball. All of those communities can be a part of this, and their families and their children will benefit greatly besides their school districts.
Is there also a value of being partners with those other districts and other institutions and maybe learning something from your perspective, saying, hey, you know, this is working in Carruthers, or we tried this over here? And is that something that comes out of this also, this, the cross-pollination?
Very much so. Collaboratives have been developed because of this, collaboratives around education that help us in terms of educating children. So the networks and relationships that have been developed would not take place because of this, and they're just starting to grow even more. Relationships with, you know, we think of Clovis, and we think of Clovis as an area of wealth. Well, Clovis has some pockets of poverty that are within the city of Fresno. Pinedale, as an example, has 91% of students in Pinedale qualify for free and reduced lunch. So this initiative, really, the ramifications for it are just beginning to be felt.
Linda, we just have about a minute left. What's the next step? This has just ramped up. It's just been announced formally. But what's the timeline like here?
Well, we in the next 3 years, we have a goal of focusing in on our three goal areas. Kindergarten readiness, we're committed to improving that by 10% a year. Right now, only 37% of our kids are ready for kindergarten when they show up in the K-12 system. Third grade reading, we are committed to a 10% improvement in the numbers of kids that are reading at grade level by third grade. And high school graduation, we have a 100% goal to make sure all of our kids in Fresno County are walking across that stage.
It's the Cradle to Career Partnership, bringing together local nonprofits, government, education. Linda Gleason, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Eric, really appreciate it for you. It's the first day of school in Fowler, so thank you so much for joining us today.
Very good.
On Valley
thank
Edition.
You for having us.
Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment on our program and talk about why Bakersfield is known for more than just oil and agriculture. It's some rare birds that are bringing people to town. That's coming up on Valley Edition. This is Valley Edition. Bakersfield is known worldwide for country music, agriculture, and oil. But what if I told you people are flocking to Kern County to birdwatch? Well, it's the truth, and as FM 89's Ezra David Romero reports, they're all looking for a non-native species that calls the city's tall palm trees home. He brings us this unlikely story.
Earlier this summer, I was doing some internet sleuthing about how to better take care of my pet parakeets. As I scrolled through search results, a line jumped off the screen. There's a wild population of parakeets living in Bakersfield. So I reached out to Kern Audubon Society, and they said I should come see the birds for myself.
We're on the lookout for the rose-ringed parakeet, which is about a 15-inch, beautiful lime green parakeet.
That's Maddie Elsie with the group. With binoculars in hand, we're wandering through Hart Park in the center of Bakersfield looking for the birds. Elsie says people from around the world have traveled here to see them. They're not tiny pet store parakeets, but a much larger bird.
Named for the male, which has a ring around its neck, a very thin band all around its neck. The juveniles and the females don't have that.
It takes a while to find them in the tall trees, but as we circle the park, they find us.
There's one. Oh, look. About six of them.
I'm like birding out right now.
Good. Once you get hooked.
I was shocked at how big they are. The green and yellow birds grew up to 16 inches long. Parakeets are technically small parrots, and what sets them apart are their long tails. But why the heck are parakeets flying around Kern County's largest city? To find out, I met with someone who studied the population of birds for decades. Allison Sheehy is a master naturalist who focuses on the Southern Sierra and Kern County. She says it all started with a weather event.
In 1977, there was a huge windstorm that hit. The winds were in excess of 100 miles an hour, and it blew apart an aviary, the happy bird aviary.
Two breeding pairs of the birds escaped.
There were a lot of other birds that escaped, but it seemed like the rose-winged parakeets were the only ones that successfully started breeding.
Almost 40 years later, the birds are thriving in Bakersfield because of the similar temperature and precipitation to India, where they're from. Sheehy estimates there are 3,000 living under the protection of palm fronds at night. By day, these birds roam the city hunting for nuts, stone fruit, and flowers to eat. Sheehy doesn't think these birds will leave the city limits, even though they are agricultural pests in other countries.
They don't seem to fly over solid land. So that basically they're kept into Bakersfield. They're not migratory. They don't fly out to Fresno or any place else.
Sheehy says they're not really pests here, and they're not harming any other species. But some people do complain about their squawks. She says the birds have adapted well to the region, but says their bills may be evolving to look like larger bills of other subspecies.
Whether it's actually genetics from that subspecies or we're seeing an evolutionary adaptation to young who can survive who have the larger bill. I don't know yet.
Every night, as the sun sets, Sheehy says the birds return to their roosts. Their main home is among the fronds of a patch of tall palm trees on the corner of Union and California Avenues in Bakersfield. It's an urban area with a food max across the street and a group home below the trees. But as I record the sound of the birds settling in for the night, people ask me what I'm up to.
I'm writing a story about these parakeets. You know there's 3,000 of them?
And when I tell them that a colony of big green parakeets live on their street, they're flabbergasted. So we look up together. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra David Romero in Bakersfield.
This is Valley Edition. It's back to school season, and that means there's a lot of news right now about local school districts, perhaps none more so than the Kern High School District, which serves more than 35,000 students in Kern County. Here to bring us up to date on a number of issues that have kept the district in the headlines, we have with us Harold Pierce with the Bakersfield Californian. Harold, welcome.
Good morning. Thanks, Joe.
It seems like this school year is picking up right where the last one left off with some controversial issues. Earlier this year, the board voted to allow firearms on campus. Now the issue is back and is getting a lot more real. What do we know right now about this application process, and where is this in terms of actually happening in real life?
Well, I'll tell you, Joe, we don't know a whole lot right now about the application process. What we know so far is that the board has approved this, I believe unanimously, to go ahead and allow concealed carry weapon permit holders to bring firearms onto campuses. However, there was some complaints at the last board meeting this month regarding that. One individual who wanted to carry his weapon on campus had come out and asked, well, I haven't received any forms yet. There's no applications. It's gone to the office. They haven't actually finalized this process yet. And when they approved it at their board meeting some time ago, they didn't actually approve it with any kind of logistics in place. They didn't know how they're going to go about approving this thing or actually carrying it out.
So it's safe to say that we don't really know exactly how many people potentially could be applying at this point, too early to know?
Well, I mean, at this point, it could be every single concealed carry weapon permit holder in Kern County, which I think is north of 4,000 permit holders at this point. And that's a real rough number there, Joe.
When it comes to guns, East High School is also in the news. What's this about a resurrected firing range on the campus?
Yeah, this is interesting, and they've gone ahead, and East Bakersfield High School campus is one that is, it's an older historic school. It was built in the 1930s, and it was actually built with an air rifle range, or maybe it was an air rifle range at the time, it was for .22 caliber rifles, in their basement, and for a long time, that was, an air rifle range up until the 1970s when the program was dismantled, probably over anti-war sentiment because of Vietnam, and so for the last 30, 40 years or so, it's been used as this repository for leftover desks and fax machines, copiers, things like that. Last year, an Eagle Scout, a teacher's kid, had gone through and cleaned that up for an Eagle Scout project. And the school had secured a $10,000 grant from the National Rifle Association for some air rifles. And now the district trustees are considering bringing back an air rifle team to that campus. So if they get that underway, they've gone through a first reading, I believe, so far. They should be able to assemble an air rifle team by next semester.
Now, I was talking about this in our office the other day, and our employees here were surprised to hear that. But some of them who are from the Midwest said, oh, we had those back when I grew up back in the Midwest. Do we know if there's any other schools in the area that have air rifle teams or shooting facilities on campus?
You know, I'm not really sure. Within the current high school district, it would seem this is probably one of the only ones that we know of. But from what you said, like you said a moment ago, this was probably very common years ago.
And are they bringing this back with the intent that it's going to be a regular sport, so to say, with CIF?
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't know. It's not necessarily a CIF sport, but it is a club sport. And one of the things they did loud about it, the trustees, was that, look, you know, the first medal in the Olympics the United States had just won was for an air rifle competition, and a 19-year-old girl had won that that medal. And could she have been able to do that without going to a school that didn't have an air rifle team in place?
Now, we're obviously talking about the Kern High School District today. The district has been in the news for a number of reasons. One of them is the fact the district's concerned it's not getting enough good press. The district is seeking to hire a PR firm to augment its existing in-house staff. What's going on there?
Yeah, Joe, this is a whole other mess. We just call it shenanigans over here. The district doesn't think they have enough good PR right now, which understandably so. They've had a lot of bad PR. Trustee Jeff Flores earlier this year had said it's been a very bloody year for the district. They lost a $10.5 million settlement to a student who had sued the district for basically gross negligence. He had been really, really badly beat up during a prep rally in 2010.
This is the famous chicken suit lawsuit.
Yeah, this is the famous chicken lawsuit, sure. So they had gone through that. They had gotten beat up over this CCW permit issue that they've been talking about for months over at this district. On top of that, they took a lot of heat for transgender bathroom laws. They were one of these districts that had really considered standing up against the state and had really... You know, I think they had even talked about possibly suing the state at one point over this transgender bathroom law issue. They didn't go that far, but trustees Chad Vegas, who was a pastor as well, had gone as far as saying that, you know, he would never enforce any kind of law that violated his ethical or moral or religious conscience. And as a result, since these wide-reaching anti-discrimination board policies have been set in place at that district, as they have in many other school districts, he has decided not to run for re-election. He can't do what he says.
Uh-oh.
So the district's taken a lot of heat over this, and as a result, the trustees are now saying they're getting negative PR and that the media is out to get them. And I think that a lot of folks in the media just see it as this is something that the trustees are doing to themselves and doing to their district.
I want to go back to Chad Vegas in a moment, but before we do that,
sure.
What is the status of the bathroom implementation of that directive from the federal government in Kern High School District?
Yeah, they've gone ahead and they've implemented these wide-reaching anti-discrimination policies that specifically mention transgender individuals. So that is basically they're conforming. They're complying with those federal directives.
We're talking with Harold Pierce, reporter with the Bakersfield Californian today, about a number of stories he's been covering regarding the Bakersfield, the Kern High School District, serving students in Bakersfield and beyond. We're talking also about these issues as they relate to some controversial national issues. You mentioned Chad Vegas. He has taken a lot of heat locally, most recently holding some meetings to encourage parents, or at least to tell parents how they can take their kids out of the schools,
yeah,
which he is sworn to represent.
He sees nothing wrong with this either, Joe, by the way. He says that he got into elected office and that he has always been a proponent of a private Christian education. But the reason he ran for elected office 12 years ago was because not every Christian family can afford a Christian education. So the way we infer it is that he's trying to kind of bring some of that flavor into public schools. Obviously, we saw it a few years ago. He brought in God We Trust signs into every classroom, things like that. He's been a pretty strong proponent of the right-wing kind of conservative Christian voice on that board. And a lot of people in this community really, really like him for that reason. A lot of others don't.
And certainly he has been a touchstone in the community. As you mentioned, you said he's not going to run for re-election. Has there been any discussion that he would continue to serve out the rest of his term, or is his dissatisfaction?
Yeah, he's going to complete the rest of his term here, Joe, and that you know, he also has a an individual, I believe his name is Joe O'Connor, or O'Connell rather, who he said he supports. He's going to run for his seat. The only other person to run for the seat is Jennifer Bloomquist, and she is a self-described godless liberal, a perfect parallel to Chad Vegas, or a counterpoint rather. So it should be an interesting election season for that particular board.
And what exactly happened, to go back, what exactly happened with that PR company? Did the district move forward with spending the money to hire that company?
You know, this is interesting because in March, on a March 7th meeting, they had gone ahead and they had provided a no-bid contract for $70,000 to Providence Strategic Consulting, which is a local company out here. They had never before that point represented an educational institution, but the district had no problem signing on a no-bid contract for some PR services that related to the bond measure they're trying to get passed in November. The district will go ahead and they'll deny that it had anything to do with the bond. They say that it's just to get positive PR out ahead of it, which is fine. But what's interesting about that particular firm is that Chad Vegas, the trustee, his nephew, works for that firm. So there was some question of whether there was a conflict of interest there, and this is something that Chad Vegas, of course, denies emphatically. He says that, you know, this was all something that was, you know, that was stirred up so that his son, or his nephew, rather, could get an entry-level job at a, you know, at a PR firm in Bakersfield. It makes no sense, he says. So he denies that.
Now, your colleague Jose Gaspar had a piece in the Californian a few days ago that dropped another bombshell regarding the district. Obviously, this is not your reporting, but what can you relate to us about this story about allegations that the district personnel, including the former district police chief, misused a state criminal justice and DMV database to look up information on students and parents? What exactly is going on there?
Yeah, it just gets worse and worse for this district. This is Jose Gaspar's reporting, and he had found that there were certain officials in the high school district, an athletic director, a director of pupil personnel, and one other, who were abusing this law enforcement database, and they were using it to run these background checks on students. So they were essentially spying on students, it seems, and you know, I can't speak to it in the level of detail that Jose probably could, but that's what I understand it as, and that's obviously it could range anywhere from a misdemeanor to a felony. It's a serious charge. I'm not sure how seriously those individuals are taking it at this point, though. The DA has not filed any charges against any high school officials. They've refused to file charges because there's insufficient evidence.
Harold Pierce with us today talking about the Kern High School District. He covers education for the Bakersfield Californian. You can read his reports online at bakersfield.com. And, of course, in the traditional printed paper. Harold, we really appreciate you taking the time to join us today.
Certainly. Thank you, Jeff.
And stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment and learn about an effort that's underway right now at Fresno State to save languages of local Native American tribes. We'll talk with the linguists who are out there working on it right now in just a moment on Valley Edition. This is Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Saving history for some people might mean collecting old photographs or ancestry records. For others, it might be documenting a family story. But for one group of researchers at Fresno State, it's a lot more than that. It's literally about saving a language. The work is underway right now at the university in dealing with the Chukchansi Revitalization and Documentation Project and the Indigenous Languages Group at the university. Joining us in our studio, we have Brian Agbayani and Niken Adisimito-Smith joining us today. Welcome to our program today, both of you.
Thank you.
I want to start with you, Niken. When you talk about saving a language, when it comes to the Chukchansi language, what does that mean in our context today?
First, a language that is safe is a language that is spoken by all generations, from grandparents, parents, and children. And there is nothing that prevents this language from being used in all types of communication. When the use of the language becomes restricted to certain domains, for example, when children speaking it only when they're at home, or when the language is only spoken by grandparents and older generation, and they don't speak it to their children or grandchildren, then that language becomes what we call endangered. So when we talk about saving a language, we talk about trying to reverse this process so that the language is once again spoken by children, parents, and grandparents in all types of communication.
How many Chukchansi speakers is it safe to say there are today?
We estimate at 12, but that's a rough estimate.
12 people?
Yes.
Total in the world that speak this language that are... That's
yes, and most of them, if not all of them, are in their 70s.
So I guess it's safe to say that there's some urgency also for your work.
Yes, this is a language that is extremely endangered.
Brian, I want to turn to you now. How do you actually go about this with such a small pool of speakers that are left? What do you do? How do you go about, A, documenting the language, and B, trying to prolong its active use with a next generation?
Well, there are different aspects of saving a language. One aspect is language documentation. We do this by systematically recording, transcribing, translating, and analyzing the language from a variety of written and spoken sources. Another aspect is developing materials for learning the language. So these could include a system to write down the language, a dictionary, a reference grammar, and language lessons. In addition, particularly for Chukchansi, there's a collection of 27 Chukchansi stories that were told in English by several Chukchansi speakers to anthropologists in the previous century. And we're in the process of translating these stories back into Chukchansi with our speakers. And these stories are part of the materials for learning Chukchansi as well. And so we're incorporating these into the learning materials.
So for our listeners, we have listeners all the way from the Kern County Mountains all the way to north of the Delta. Give us an idea of the native range of the Chukchansi language. And is it related to other Native American languages in the area, or is it wholly unique?
Actually, Chukchansi is a variety of what we call Yokuts language. It's part of the Penutian language group. And there are, so correct me, how many dialects about?
I don't know.
Yeah, quite a few dialects, maybe 19, 20 dialects. It's quite a big group. Chukchansi is one of these dialects. It's to some extent, depending on the range. So we're looking at from Bakersfield up to through the valley, into the foothills, into the mountains. So a very large area in which these languages were spoken. And many of these, some of these languages are if they're geographically close together, are mutually intelligible with one another. But then there's languages that are very, very different from one another in terms of, they really don't have so much in common.
Yeah. Let's go ahead and now listen to something. You have this recording of the Chukchansi language on your phone here. We're going to hold this up to the microphone. I apologize. We don't have a better way of doing this, but I think it should come across. Let's listen to some of the recording that your project has done. Tell us about this.
Yeah, this is a story about the skunk and the stink bug. And it's basically a story about how the stink bug became black. So I'll play the story. It's all in Chukchansi. It was retold by Holly Wyatt, who's a native speaker.
Yeah, let's listen to a portion.
Namich wodiga me in get weyak orsto hatim ta soch.
Is it difficult as a linguist to work on preserving a language, one that you yourself don't speak?
It could, however, as linguists, we're actually trained to work with pretty much any language.
Mm-hmm.
So it is difficult, but that's the reason why we started this project since summer 2009, and we're making progress. However, we're nowhere near the end line.
So what would the end line look like? What would that progress be? Is it getting those younger speakers? Is it like a first we have to document it, then we have to teach it to the next generation, or are there blanks that you have to fill in some places? What does the process look like as far as that goes?
Well, the end line would be when everybody, the members of the community, actually use the language for everything, in daily activities. That's the end line. In between, it would be what, as Brian mentioned earlier, using the different language materials that we have developed, like writing down the writing system and using the dictionary and the reference grammar, training teachers to teach the language to the young generations and among the adults too.
You mentioned the writing system. Tell me about that. Is this a language that came historically pre-Columbian period with a writing system? And if not, what is that system that they use today?
It was not written. And we actually created the writing system in the summer of 2006.
So you created essentially a new alphabet or a new...
We just used the Roman alphabet,
okay,
actually, and based on the sounds
phonetics
that the language has, and we use that too.
It sounds like an absolutely fascinating field, especially given the fact that there is a pressure to get this done. With only 12 native speakers of this language left, is it also more than just documenting the vocabulary and grammar and syntax and those sorts of things, but also things pronunciation and those things that in some cases, filling in the blanks there. What's it like actually doing this work?
Yeah, it's really exciting and it's very interesting to see people reconnect with their past and reconnect with the language. And it's certainly a challenge. There are a lot of things about Chukchansi that are different from English. A lot of the sounds, as you heard, many sounds are very different. But it's something that also the elders who speak the language can share with the younger people. And it's very nice to see that connection happening and for all the people to connect with that.
Has it helped them reconnect with their language? And because I often hear people who have a second language that they don't use all that often, they can get a little bit rusty with it. Mm-hmm. Has this project helped those speakers, especially the ones who are now in their 70s, has it helped them reconnect with some of their earlier memories and community stories and things like that?
It seems that it has, based on our meetings, our regular weekly meetings. It seems that certain expressions then all of a sudden came out.
Is there a point of discovery where you as the linguist are sitting there and all of a sudden, wow, we just learned something new about this language we didn't know before?
Oh, yes. It's every day is like that. And it is for us as well as for the Hali Wayat who we've been working with.
What's the hardest part of doing this?
Well, the hardest part is knowing that there's so much to be done, I think. There's so much to be done and that we have such a limited amount of time to do it in. I think that realization, that's the hardest part of it.
And now it's obviously you two who are working on this project. Are students involved as well? What's the overall scope of this? It sounds like you have a lot of weight on your backs trying to save a language in the next decade or so.
Yes, we have two other faculty members involved, Chris Golston and John Boyle, as well as a number of students who are involved with the project. We work very closely also with Kim Lahone up in Coarse Gold, who's an education specialist up there. A lot of people are invested and working very hard in this project.
It's the Chuck Chansey Revitalization and Documentation Project and the Indigenous Languages Group at Fresno State. Researchers and students there working to document and preserve the native tongue of the Chukchansi people of the foothills of Madera County. There are just 12 speakers of that language left, and Fresno State's doing that work today. We'd like to thank our guests, Niken Adisimito-Smith, and also with us today, Brian Agbayani, both professors in the Department of Linguistics at Fresno State. Thanks to both of you for being here today and for your good work and trying to save this language. It's part of our history in Central California.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, we'd like to thank you for listening and also invite you to send us your comments. We want to know what you think. You can email us. Our address is talk@kvpr.org. You can also send us a tweet. We are @KVPR and @Valley Edition. And find us on Facebook as well. We are in the search box under Valley Public Radio. And be sure to follow our page to get all the latest updates on local news stories and more, including Valley Edition segments. That's all on the web at kvpr.org, where you can also find and subscribe to our podcast. Again, kvpr.org. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporters Jeffrey Hess and Carrie Klein, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.